Welcome to the 62nd Scripture Roundtable of the Interpreter Foundation. My name is Daniel Peterson, and with me for this roundtable is, at least on the left of my screen, Craig Foster, and then to the right of my little spot, Jeffrey Bradshaw, and to his right, John Gee. Oh no, there I am. So, in the center, that must be Martin Tanner, not me. Martin Tanner's wide screen right now. He'll be doing a lot of the tech stuff, without which we could not do anything here. We are going to be discussing Lesson 12 in the 2014 Gospel Doctrine Manual. That is a lesson that focuses essentially on the story of Joseph in Egypt, starting with chapter 40 of Genesis and going through chapter 45. It's a very nice, relatively lengthy, single story. And I might mention, just as by way of introduction, that this story has been beloved and venerated and told and retold in various locations and cultures. Even in the Muslim Quran, in the 12th surah or chapter of the Quran, which is called Surat Yusuf, the chapter of Joseph, this is the one chapter of the Quran that is devoted entirely to a single story, and it's the story of Joseph and his brothers, and the casting of Joseph away by his brothers, his rise to power in Egypt, and the eventual happy resolution, told much the way it's told in the Bible. There are a few differences, but they're not enormous. And the story is very popular in early Christian literature as well. So my strategy for this was simply to start with chapter 40, in which Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh's chief butler and chief baker, and then the upshot is Joseph is kind of hoping that some good will come to him out of this, but it doesn't right away. And I think Jeff, you had something to say about those dreams. Are you there, Jeff?
Beep, Dan? Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. There's a little bit of cutting out. Yeah, I think it's interesting that it starts out this chapter with interpretation of dreams, just like Joseph's own story started out that way. His dreams, Joseph's dreams, were questioned by his brothers. And now the fact that we're going to see that his interpretation of others' dreams now confirmed prepares us to understand that Joseph's dreams about himself are going to be fulfilled, and that's exactly what we see here. Just a word about the prison. Incarceration in prisons was really unknown in the ancient Near East, but we do have the notion of prisons in Egypt, but they weren't for criminals who committed sort of the nefarious crimes. They're more for political prisoners. Here, had Potiphar's wife been believed about her accusations of Joseph, Joseph would have likely been executed immediately rather than cast in prison. So the fact he's put in with political prisoners awaiting judgment and later on given administrative authority might be taken as implying that Potiphar was skeptical about his wife's story. He's about 28 years old at the time he interprets the dreams. He, since he'll be 30 when he appears before Pharaoh, so that means he's been in slavery for 11 years, but it's impossible to say how many of those years were spent in prison and how many were spent working for Potiphar. He's there now put in charge of the butler and the baker, who would have been, I think that would have been a position of honor to be in charge of these very high-ranking officials in prison. The butler was the Pharaoh's cupbearer, so he was a very powerful official because he had continual access to the king. He brought him his drink, and he could be seen as more or less whispering in his ear anything that people would love to have whispering in his ear. For that reason, he had to be beyond reproach, not only because he was so close to the king physically and close to his ear, but also in a court filled with intrigue. The possibility of poisoning the king's cup or his food was always at hand. And so some have thought, that offense of the butler and the baker may have been the fact that the king got sick after a meal and inferred that his food had been poisoned. Until they got to the fact of the matter, the butler and the baker were going to be in prison. Now, I think we all know the story of the two dreams, which are quite parallel in some ways. The butler dreams of bringing the cup back to Pharaoh again and and the baker has all the sweet meats and bakery goods on his head. In his case, however, the birds eat off of his head, and so it's not quite as clear what's going to happen to him. So we hear the clear story first. And there's a grim play on words. It occurred to me this morning in the interpretation of the two dreams. I was trying to think about how to describe this. And the best idea I had was in the Magic Flute, you have that great aria, O Endless Night, where Tamino is waiting to hear whether Pamina is alive or dead. And the music draws out the tension by repeating her name slowly three times. Pamina, 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 Lebet. And then you're going to wait and see. You're just fearing it's going to be nicht, that she's not alive anymore. And instead they say, Pamina, Lebet, noch. She yet lives. She's still alive. And then you rejoice with Tamino that it's happened. In the same way, you have the initial part of Joseph's interpretation in just a beautiful literary twist to the butler and the baker is the same with the twist in the end. To the butler, Joseph says, yet within 3 days, Pharaoh shall lift up thine head, in this case, in an honorable thing, and restore thee unto thy place. But to the baker, he says, well, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thy head. And in the movie version of this, you can see the baker almost smiling in anticipation that he's going to be given a place of honor again too. But in his case, he says, the Pharaoh shall lift up thy head from off thee. And he's going to be hung, not hung by the neck with a noose as we do in our days, but probably impaled and hung to be eaten by the very birds that he envisioned dream. Now, the next thing that I just wanted to say, and I'll finish up, I know I'm kind of going on a while here, is that the butler eventually, as we know, after the dream of Pharaoh, remembers Joseph and brings him out of the dungeon. The word for dungeon is the Hebrew word bor, literally pit, which is the same place where Joseph's misery began when he was cast into the pit by his brothers. The careful reader, then, is meant to understand that we just passed an important hinge point of the story. Just as Joseph's misery began when he was cast into the pit, now we anticipate that his era of good fortune begins, because he's brought out of the pit. Joseph himself is not unaware of this good omen, because he says in verse 16 of chapter 41, God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. It's God who's brought him out of the pit at last. He was cast in really twice, once by his brothers and then once by Potiphar, and now he's being brought out, and he knows that God will certainly now also grant him an interpretation that's going to answer all of Pharaoh's questions and bring him into a position of favor in the court. So I'll just leave that here, and maybe somebody else would like to speak to Pharaoh's dreams.
You know, it strikes me, by the way, while you've mentioned it, the idea of the pit and being taken out of the pit, that you can read that Christologically, too. Obviously, Jews would not, and I'm not saying this was intended, but, of course, it's God's power to deliver you from the depths. And hell itself, the spirit prison, spirit world, is sometimes referred to as the pit. And yet God ultimately, through the Savior, delivers us from the pit. So you can see a kind of foreshadowing of that great theological theme there. John, did you have anything you wanted to observe about this part of the story?
A couple of things. So first off, the dreams, I guess I'm going to disagree a little bit with Jeff about the existence of prisons and their uses in Egypt, but I'll just, from my reading of the ancient sources, I don't see them as being completely different from ours. Most of the we have a tale from Egypt that comes from about Moses' time that reflects a lot of some of the accusations with Pharaoh and similar accusations that are leveled, and those and that tale shows that is a little more ambiguous about whether the accusations would be taken as face value in the result of them. But for me, some of the interesting things about the dreams are there's a whole history of dream interpretation in Egypt, and sometimes they play off cultural metaphors that are a little obscure to us. And I won't elaborate on all of them, but when Joseph has his dreams and is interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, the sheaves that Pharaoh sees, the hieratic sign for those is almost identical to the hieratic sign for the word for years. So you see seven sheaves and 7 years, and an Egyptian would say, oh yeah, that's the same sign, that makes sense. And then the cattle, you see seven cattle come up, and the cattle, there's a motif in Egyptian stories about seven, the seven Hathors, who are usually depicted as cows, and that they prophesy future events. And they're also noted for bringing in grain in abundance. Both of those come in to his interpretation of Pharaoh's dream. And so, although the interpreters, and we have one or two dream manuals partially preserved, Pharaoh could send to his priests and ask for an interpretation, and they might look it up and not have it in there, because these manuals, by their very nature, can't be exhaustive. You can't include all the strange stuff that you might see in a dream. But his interpretation would reflect on the kind of thing that an Egyptian would look at and say, oh yeah, that makes sense. This is a sound interpretation. The other thing that's interesting about it is when we look at chronologically when those interpretations might appear, Joseph lives during what we would call the second intermediate period. This is a time period in Egypt where there is basically a civil war going on. So you have the north half of the country versus the south half of the country. Joseph will end up settling in the north half, in the Israelites, in the Delta area. And there are two dynasties there. There's the earlier one, which may be Amorite, some people have thought, or they're Canaanite at least in origin. And then the following one is the famous Hyksos dynasty, but that's the time period when he lives. But that time period is the time period when those interpretations would make the most sense. So you would see them, you could see them maybe as early as the Middle Kingdom, that's Abraham's day, but when you get down to Moses' day, they're no longer current. So it hits the right spot chronologically.
Okay. Oh, that's quite interesting. Then there are legitimate Egyptianate motifs in these dreams and in these chapters in this story. So yeah. It's not something that some Hebrew who knew nothing of Egypt had made up. At least there are clues indicating that it does have some sort of Egyptian connection.
And it's also a connection where if it's some later Hebrew making it up, you couldn't match the interpretations that you would expect to find in that time period. So it reflects Joseph's day.
Right. Okay. Craig or Martin, do you have anything to say about that particular chapter?
No.
All right. One thing that strikes me, John, you talked about the dream interpretation manuals.
Yes.
And I think it's significant in the next chapter, this is a good segue, I suppose, in the next one, that when when Joseph is called in, well, put it this way, you have these two dejected guys in jail or whatever they're in, and part of their dejection might come from the fact that they've had what they know are significant dreams, but they're not exactly around the court. The dream experts aren't there to ask. So what do you know?
Yes.
There's this Hebrew guy who can answer the question, you know? And so when he comes into the Pharaoh's court, he's brought in hastily out of the dungeon, it says, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, verse 15 of chapter 41, I've dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I've heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And so I guess he's assuming that Joseph is somehow one of these dream experts, you know, the kind he's familiar with, probably studied the manuals. Joseph responds and answers Pharaoh in verse 16, saying, it is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And I think it's significant. He's saying, look, I'm not going to be giving you interpretation based on my study of the manuals. I'm not trained for this ministry, right? This comes by revelation, inspiration. That's how I'm able to do what I do.
And along with that, two things also occur to me. One of them is yes, he's not trained for it, but there are Egyptian stories about priests being brought in that the Pharaoh's never heard about or never seen that are able to do things that the ones that he's familiar with can't do.
Uh-huh.
Papyrus Vondi is a nice example of that. But the other thing that occurs to me is the title of the butler and the baker. Butler is an Egyptian title. It's an official one. It's something that you would carve on your sarcophagus. It's an important title. Baker, who cares about bakers? Especially if you read the Egyptian literature, bakers are pretty low on the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also this political edge to it. So, Pharaoh's friend, the guy he knows, is kept around, and then the baker, well, yeah, what's a baker?
Yeah, yeah. He's expendable.
You know, if you look, kind of relating this to a little bit later, quite a bit later, if you look in British history, for example, Butler was not only a position, obviously, it was a title, and the butler, for example, you have in Irish history the chief butler of Ireland. So he was the king's butler in that he literally would serve a wine to the king in a very ceremonial way, but he held great power, great office,
and the Egyptians do too.
That's what I was wondering. If, as I read that, that's what I kind of pictured, was that this is more than just a butler. This is really someone with great influence, great office,
yes.
Title, basically.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it works.
Interesting. Well, I think people are pretty familiar with the dream that the Pharaoh has of the fat cows and the lean cows and the nice ears of corn or whatever they are, presumably not maize, and then the lean ears. I'm struck with the fact that this is a trivial, minor thing, but that the seven thin ears are blasted with the east wind. I don't know off the top of my head whether Egyptians had a notion of the east wind as a really negative thing. People living in Palestine obviously did, because the west wind came off the Mediterranean and brought moisture. The east wind came off the Jordanian, Syrian, Iraqi desert to the east and brought heat, blasting sand sometimes. So, you know, it was a metaphor. You even find it in the Book of Mormon for destruction coming. You'll reap the east wind. It's not a good thing to reap. But I don't know if that's specifically Egyptian or if that would be more something in Israelite idiom.
I think it's more an Israelite idiom. The Khamsin that comes in Egypt comes from the west.
Yes,
and the prevailing winds are either from the north or come in from the northwest, but are mainly north-south. And so the big emphasis in most of the Egyptian texts, as far as winds go, they talk about the four winds, but the north one is the one they pay the most attention to. But that's a blessed wind,
yeah,
because you drop your sails and you can just float down the Nile current. You pop your sails up, and that north wind takes you upstream, so you don't have to do much,
yeah,
to get your boats up and down the Nile. And yeah, so,
yeah, that would be a great thing. Let me say, by the way, about the destructive power of winds, I'm a veteran of several Khamseens. The word means 50, and the idea is that it lasts over a period of about 50 days. Not necessarily every day, but it can happen anytime during that 50-day period. They are absolutely hellish winds. When we knew it was coming, the skies would turn dark. The dust was so thick in the air, you would tape. You'd use tape on the windows to try to cover all the possible ways it could get in. I still remember sitting there trying to read in my living room and having to dust off the pages of the book in order to turn them. You know, and you thought, I am breathing this. It's just everywhere. Egyptian weather is normally reasonably nice, and it's hot, but it's reasonably nice. But oh, the Khamseen can be really, really tough, and so that's you don't take these winds lightly. Any comments about the dream of Pharaoh and Joseph's response to it from any of you? Silence.
Well, I'd already covered it.
Yeah, you did.
A little earlier, so I don't want to repeat that.
but it does fit the Egyptian context. I thought that was an important point that you made. So Pharaoh is more reasonable than Nebuchadnezzar, right, who demands that people interpret the dream and he won't tell them what the dream is. That's a little rough. This Pharaoh is a more reasonable fellow. He tells you the dream, and then Joseph is able to interpret it. And Joseph says in verse 32 of chapter 41 that because the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it's because the thing is established by God and God will shortly bring it to pass. So I guess that emphasizes it, gives it a sense of urgency. So then Joseph immediately begins laying out a program of what Pharaoh ought to do to respond to the situation. Let Pharaoh do this, 34, let him appoint officers over the land, take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years, you know, that are going to come. There's always been one lack, one thing missing there that struck me, and I don't know whether it's inadvertent or whether they just really seized the grain, and then later on, when it's seven lean years, they sold it to everybody. It's a pretty good deal if you're the Pharaoh. You tax away the people's grain, and then you sell it back to them when they're all desperate for it. It's a chance to gather up a lot of the harvest, impose a huge tax, and so on and so forth. I've always found that kind of funny from a political point of view.
Well, taxes in Egypt, although I'm more familiar with the later version, so in later times, they could, whoever owns the land usually gets between one-third to one-half of whatever it produces. And so the pharaohs would often reassign that land, but they'd rent it out to people, and they could. So it's effectively a third to half tax.
Mm.
And then they would fill up the temple granaries with all of the excess. And that's usually the way they funded their religion, but mm-hmm. they also funded the civil things as well. And they had there are time periods. This is actually a time period when we don't have enough records to say exactly how they were doing it then. Mm-hmm. Joseph lives in the Delta. Delta has produced very little in way of papyrus documents, so we can't really
there's a good reason. Check. It's sodden with water. I mean, the rest of Egypt is dry and preserves things well, but the delta, by definition, the river delta, is...
And the archaeologist, if they dig down, by the time you get to Greco-Roman times, you're underwater.
Yeah, right.
And so if you get way down to Joseph's time, then it's horribly soggy. Even the New Kingdom, when we've got a lot of material from Egypt, we have no papyri from the Delta.
Mm.
And so part of it we is simply we don't know because the documents haven't been preserved. And but if we look at other time periods in Egypt, yeah, we can see that the taxes can get quite heavy, and they in this case they're saving it. A couple of things that are also interesting is that in most Egyptian literary accounts, they will say that Pharaoh's advisors told him this, and Pharaoh decided to do something else, and he takes his own counsel. But in actuality, they may say this, but the Pharaoh does listen to his advisors. That's why he's got them. And this is a remarkable case where he actually listens to somebody instead of just doing, you know, the Pharaoh is considered to be a god. And right. So he, in most of the accounts where they actually write, the Pharaoh always takes credit for it. But in actuality, they will have to listen to some advisors, and it shows a great wisdom on this Pharaoh's part that he's willing to listen to a slave.
Right. Right. All right. Any other comments about this chapter? I noticed one thing, that he marries Asenath, as she's often called, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. On is still there. It's, in fact, I just wanted to give this little practical detail for those who may have been to Egypt. If you've flown into Egypt, you land out at a place still called today Heliopolis, the city of the sun, Greek. That's On, essentially, as I understand it. So everywhere you go in Egypt, you're walking on ancient soil where the ancients lived, and in this case, a biblical site as well. Any other comments about this chapter?
Martin, I think you went over Joseph and Asenath, didn't you?
I did. I think you had some thoughts about this as well. But to me, this is one of the great parts about the story that it's hardly a line in the Bible, and yet there's another document, the apocryphal work of Joseph and Asenath, that answers a lot of questions that if you read this chapter, you might have. How is this Jewish person, Joseph, who loves the God of Israel, what's he doing marrying an Egyptian woman? How does that work out? And how is it that that he is able to see her as someone acceptable, and how can this Egyptian woman be the mother of Ephraim and Manasseh, who
and not only is she an Egyptian woman, she's the daughter of a priest of Egypt. Right. I mean,
precisely.
Of course, you remember that the native Egyptians aren't in charge of the dynasty this point anyway. But
right.
So at any rate, the point that I was going to make here, and I'll make it fairly quickly, is that there's this great apocryphal work. The earliest copy that we have dates to about the 6th century AD, or of the Common Era, if you want to be scholarly about this, and is generally considered to date to the 1st or 2nd century BCE. And in it, it answers all these questions. It has this beautiful little description of Joseph and Asenath falling in love, and about how she changes religions. She sees that her religion that she, excuse me, has grown up with is not correct, and she follows the God of Israel. And because of that, it makes sense that Joseph could fall in love with her. And then you have this wonderful description of an angel appearing to her, described actually in some details reminiscent of how Joseph Smith described Angel Moroni coming, a robe and bright, glorious description. And then it has this wonderful description of Asenath. I guess the short way to say it would be that it appears to someone with an LDS background, to somebody who is receiving some kind of covenant or endowment or something similar to what one might see, not identical, but analogous to what one might see in the temples. And so there's a lot to read there. And it has something that non-LDS scholars would see as similar to some of the ideas that are found in the Nag Hammadi texts, the idea of special rituals that are not known to the public at large or the religion at large. And so it answers all of these great questions and describes in enough detail so that one who is Jewish and looks at this story goes, oh, okay, that all works out. That all makes sense, that Joseph is really marrying this woman and that she can really be the mother of these two great figures, Ephraim and Manasseh, in Jewish history. I'll leave it there.
Thank you. Was there another comment that we wanted to make about this? Jeff, did you have something to say about Joseph and Asenath?
No, I think Martin's made a good summary there.
I'll just
concur. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I've read that where some people suggest that she might even have had Hebrew heritage. I find that, I don't know, far-fetched, but have you heard anything about that? Or
remember that the rulers in Egypt where Joseph is are actually, to use the phrase from the Book of Abraham, partakers of the blood of the Canaanites by birth. You look at the pharaoh's names, and a lot of them are Semitic names.
Okay.
And so the ruling class is not native Egyptian at that time period. So
there might be something
entirely far fetched, but a lot of it, we're speculating here.
Right.
So we can look and say, all right, well, it's possible one way, and it's also entirely possible that she's a native Egyptian. And so we don't have enough historical information to really say, but it's certainly possible that she could be Canaanite and could come from that sort of Hebrew heritage. But you got to realize that the Egyptians really didn't care about race, and that's not an important thing to them, and so they don't particularly keep track of it at this time.
Okay. Well, all right, into chapter 42. We now learn that the famine is more widespread than we'd initially suspected. It's affecting the land of Canaan, too, essentially Israel today. And so this brings in, we've been focused on Joseph, hearing his story. Well, what's been happening to the rest of the family? Now we see them again, and they're affected by the famine. And so Jacob, getting very old but still in charge, decides to send his sons into Egypt. now, he does not send them all. He wants to keep Benjamin home. Benjamin, son of the right hand, clearly his favorite, the last trace of his favorite wife, doesn't want to risk him. So he sends the other 10. Into Egypt to see if they can get some grain. Any comments about this section of the story? Silence again.
I guess to me the interesting part, I don't know if we want to jump ahead, but it's interesting that Joseph in essence, is putting his brothers to the test, and I actually use the Hebrew word for test in there a little bit later. The tables are turned in every angle of this story, and what we're going to see is if they are going to be as loyal now to Joseph as they were disloyal to Joseph, as loyal to Benjamin as they were to, and their father as they were disloyal to Joseph.
Yeah.
So when we get to that, I don't know if anybody if people would like to jump forward to that, but that to me is just a very interesting set of circumstances we're in.
Yeah, you know, I think Joseph is testing them in a way to see, are these the same slime balls that did me in earlier, you know, or have they maybe grown? Are they a little bit better than they used to be? And so he really puts them to the test. And it goes on for a while, and you can see them just in agony and you know, going up and down. I mean, what in the world is he doing to us? What's going on? This guy is... And the strangest things happen to them. It's an interesting story, and it's been told and retold. Of course, even Thomas Mann, the great Nobel laureate German author, did a novelization of Joseph and his brothers, you know, based on this. So, but they understand.
Five volumes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah, not just a little thing. Five volumes. You'd almost think he was Russian. The length he wrote. Well, verse 21, they recognize that some of this may be coming to them as their just deserts. Verse 21, they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us." And then you have a couple of the brothers sort of distinguish themselves, Judah and Reuben particularly. Who were the two who tried to mitigate the situation with Joseph earlier? Step forward a little bit in this story once again, but they do sort of hang together, and they're much more concerned about their father's feelings than it seems to me they were in the many years before, 20 plus years before, when they came with this lying story about Joseph to their father Israel. I might say something, by the way.
What's interesting, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting, though, is that whereas this is sort of foreshadowing Judah's ascension to be the true
right.
leader among the tribes. Reuben is the natural. He's the eldest. He does take some initiative. But you look at when Jacob is worried about Benjamin, he says, "Go ahead and take my sons. You can kill them if I don't bring Benjamin back." And the Jewish Rashi, I think it was, who said, "What? You think that your sons are not my sons? You think that's going to repair anything for me to lose
yeah.
two more? That's probably
right.
courageous of you." Whereas we see Judah, after his experience with Tamar, which I think we talked about last time, is a growth experience in some ways. He's willing to sacrifice himself, and it's clear his growth as a character, both in personal maturity, self-sacrifice, is later reflected in the blessing he receives from Jacob, where the scepter will, in essence, be his in the end. And
yeah.
And so that's an important subtext to look at Reuben and Judah, their interplay, as you said, Dan, in this story, and see how he became prominent among Leah's sons, just as Joseph was preeminent among Rachel's.
Right. Right. Okay, any other observations on this chapter? Chapter 42? John, do you have something you want to add to that?
I was just turning my page.
Well, that drew the attention of the camera and the computer to you.
Okay, well, the only thing that I find really interesting is the little detail about working with the interpreters. And that Joseph, after several years in Egypt, is good enough in Egyptian that his brothers don't pick up that he can speak their language as well.
Right.
And so he works it through the interpreters, and it's an acknowledgement of things that we don't really think about because we're all reading in English, that these are two very different languages that
right.
are spoken. to the point where most biblical scholars today, if they pick up another ancient language from Hebrew, they'll pick up one closely related and they won't bother learning Egyptian.
Right. No, and we often forget that, but these people are going back and forth through an interpreter, and it gives him an advantage. He can understand what they're saying. If they're discussing among themselves, they wouldn't think that he could understand it, so presumably some of the talking might have been done right in front of him, and he just has to look clueless that he can understand it all, and then he speaks to them in Egyptian. I have a brother-in-law who speaks fluent Japanese and works as an engineer for Hewlett-Packard, and for a while, part of his job was to go over on trade missions to Japan. They'd always had a problem with the Japanese would talk among themselves and then say yes or no, you know, to this or that proposition from Hewlett-Packard. His job, he was explicitly told, was to sit there and look stupid while listening to the conversation back and forth. So afterwards he could tell the Hewlett-Packard people they didn't like the proposal for this reason. This is what they want to see, so on and so forth. Finally gave himself away, though. They went out to a restaurant, and the waiter came by and asked a question, and he slipped and answered. All the Japanese he was with said, "What? You speak Japanese? Whoops." It wasn't industrial espionage, but it was just, you know, just finding, because they could understand the Americans talking, but the Americans couldn't understand them. But, you know, that would give Joseph a kind of advantage in dealing with them. He always had the upper hand, not only because he was more powerful, but because he knows their language and they don't know his.
So. And he knows what they're saying.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, yes.
Oh, no, I was just going to go on. So let's go on to the next
chapter. Let's go on to 43. Jacob is persuaded to send Benjamin to Egypt. Joseph's brethren make obeisance to him. And, you know, he'd had this dream before that they would bow to him. Of course, it's one of the things that irritated them. But, in fact, it's coming true. They really are bowing to him. He's in a position of enormous power over them. And they're bowing to him. The dream is being fulfilled. So what do you want to observe about this particular chapter? The narrative is fairly straightforward. Is there anything we should point out?
Well, the one thing that I was interested in was that Joseph forgives his brothers, but he tests them first.
Yeah.
He wants to make sure that they've repented. And we think about Joseph as a great example of forgiveness, and he is, and we're told that we need to forgive. But when God tells us, you know, I will forgive whom I will forgive, but of you is required to forgive all men, there's no time frame for when that forgiveness comes and when that forgiveness is expected of us. You know, for a lot of things in the normal daily milling about in our families, there's a lot of things we just need to forgive immediately. But there are sometimes when you can't forgive immediately, or it's very difficult to. And just to take an extreme example, you know, someone who is suffering abuse. You just don't say to them, oh, you need to go forgive your abuser. Never mind the fact that your abuser hasn't repented, isn't repenting, you know, probably just keep abusing you. It's not necessarily appropriate to put our timelines on somebody else's repentance and forgiveness. And Joseph tests to make... His brothers did some awful things to him. They were trying to kill him, and he tests to make sure that their repentance is real and gives his forgiveness. But he's tested to make sure that their repentance is real and that it's not... if they're the same old murdering conspirators, then... I'm not sure what the story would have been, but fortunately they'd repented and he recognized it and he forgave them.
Right. Good point.
This is the part that, if I could jump in for just a moment, that I am every single time I read this part of the Bible touched by, because Joseph is in such a position of power. He doesn't have to forgive them for anything. This is an act of real condescension and genuine forgiveness, for which he receives nothing other than the repair of his family relationships. He has nothing else to gain. He has no ulterior motives. This is a pure act of goodness. And that's the part that is so, I think, touching to us all as we read it. This is such a great part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons why the story has resonated so much and has been, as I say, novelized. And we didn't even mention the great Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, which takes such a solemn approach to the topic. But you learn a lot about the story from that one, can't you?
No, and I'll tell you, I have been singing Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat songs in my head all day today as I've been thinking about the roundtable we were going to have tonight. I think I was driving my wife crazy because I kept humming different tunes.
They're hummable.
They are.
One little thing that I noticed in chapter 43 that is just a detail. In chapter 43, verse 33, "And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one at another." I guess the implication is there that he seats them in rank order. And at this point, this is a little bit of a hint. This guy knows something about you, or there's something uncanny about him. He's able to place you in order of birth. And so that's why they're so astonished that that this eminent Egyptian official who shouldn't know them at all is able to just set them out in birth order. So there's a foreshadowing there of the disclosure that's going to come.
And it's a truly a psychological thriller in that sense, just kind of going a little bit into 44. What does he return to their sacks but silver for the second time?
Yeah.
This the same silver, and it wouldn't have been silver coin. It would have been silver pieces, just like they sold it for. They can't leave it in Egypt. It keeps coming back to haunt them, as it were. And then you talk about, you know, his ability to see into their hearts, and what do they leave in Benjamin's sack? That cup by which he divines.
Yeah.
So now that psychological thrill, oh no, this is the man who not only knows how to seat us in order, but he knows everything about us.
That's right.
So they are truly shaking in their boots, as any of us in those circumstances.
It's kind of a psyops.
Even though they don't know him.
Yeah, it's kind of a psyops maneuver. He's really playing with them a little bit.
The silver is probably not coins. The standard thing is to have coils of it.
That
you could snip off little ringlets or something. And that's just the standard way to do it. And the Egyptian standard currency is to write it as in silver. That's the standard monetary thing. Monetary unit. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the verse before the one you read, Dan, that says they set them by themselves, and they said the Egyptians might eat bread, might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that would that is an abomination to the Egyptians. And they talk later when they come down in there as to say that there's that we're not going to live with the Egyptians because we eat the abomination of the Egyptians. Well, the one thing that the Egyptians abominate is pigs. And there's actually a site out in the Delta that's been suggested for Goshen where they found a lot of pig bones. Now, this is before the Law of Moses, so pigs aren't prohibited to them to eat at the time. I just wondered if those details actually fit together. And so that's
interesting.
That would make the Israelite swine herds as well, which probably didn't go over well with later authors who or editors who are under the Law of Moses.
Right,
that's prohibited.
I can imagine a collection of traditional ancient Jewish pork recipes. just something a little odd about that. okay. Well, we're actually moving along in time, so we need to move along in the chapters. Chapter 44. This is such a wonderful story, and there's so much that could be said about it. You know, this is the case where you have Joseph arranging to stop the return of his brethren to Canaan. Judah offers himself in place of Benjamin for their father's sake. And it's this really noble act because he's basically condemning himself to a life of servitude if Joseph takes him up on it. So it really is.
Or worse.
Mm-hmm. So it's a great gesture. And it turns out to be only a gesture, but he couldn't have known that. It was presumably quite sincere and with full recognition of what the implications might be. So Judah is stepping forward and taking a remarkable position. Any other comments on that chapter? I know we have some things we want to say about chapter 45 and the sequels.
Right.
well, maybe we'll move along there. This, of course, is the chapter in which Joseph makes himself known to his brethren. They rejoice together. You got to imagine it's a slightly awkward scene when the brethren realize, oh, yeah, this, oh, man, he knows what we did. We did it to him. How awkward. But Pharaoh invites Jacob and his family to dwell in Egypt and eat the fat of the land. So there's an important point here where Joseph takes the rosiest possible view. He could be really angry with these guys. Heck, he could have had them executed. In a sense, they deserved it. But he doesn't do that. And he says, I am Joseph, you know, don't worry. Now therefore, verse 5, be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. And to me, there's another prefiguration, in a way, of the atonement and its capacity to take bad things, and the power of God to take bad things. Maybe not give us, as C.S. Lewis repeatedly says in Chronicles of Narnia, he doesn't give you necessarily what you would have had without the transgression, but he gives you something different and transmutes the transgression into something good nonetheless, that good can come out of even evil because God is that powerful. He's a chess player who knows all the moves and can meet any move we sinful mortals make, and he'll turn it into victory. And that's what he does in this case. Could there have been another way of doing this? I don't know, you know, that they would have been preserved during this famine. But God uses Joseph's position in Egypt to save the people he's chosen. However unworthy they may be, he's chosen them and he preserves them. And he uses that power to do it. Any comments about this before we go on to the sequel?
Yeah. Well, the... You know, that is, I've thought of that as I've read that in, before, and when I read it in preparation for this, it once again kind of struck me that even as you talked about, would there have been a different way if Joseph had not been sold into Egypt? And, yeah, probably, but that's what happened. He was sold into Egypt, and so... God basically prepared a way for the children of Israel to go into Egypt where they were saved and then eventually where their descendants were held in captivity and had to be freed by Moses, etc. And I thought to myself, well, do we have examples of God preparing a way in other events? And yes, we have examples from the Book of Mormon. We have examples from church history, and I want to mention just two really quickly. One is the Smith family was living in Vermont. They needed to get out to the western part of New York where everything was going to take place. Now, with everything that happened, was this just to get the Smith family out to New York? I don't know, and quite frankly, I doubt it. But since God knows all things, he knew that this was going to happen, that the effects would make the Smith family move, and that was the year without a summer. Right. And that was in 1816, and the results of the eruption of Mount Tambora, I looked it up to make sure I remembered which volcano it was, where the ash was up in the atmosphere, and there was extreme cold across the northern part of the world. You have it across Europe, you have it across North America, and where it literally snowed in the summer there in New England, destroying crops, destroying what little Joseph Smith Sr. had, since he was always living on the edge anyway. And because of that disaster, that economic disaster, he had to go somewhere else to try to start over again, and that ended up being the Palmyra area. So that's one example where the Smith family had to get there, and this was the way that they did. Now, I have another example, and I kind of hesitated to give this because I don't want to downplay what happened to the Donner Party, or make it sound like, well, God decided to kill off a bunch of people just to help the Mormons. But you look at what happened. The Donner Party traveled to California the year previous to the Saints traveling west to the Great Basin. The thing that was that there were a number of things that slowed the Donner Party down, that they eventually ended up getting trapped in the Sierra Nevada mountains with the winter storms. But probably the most significant thing that slowed them down so much was when they took the Hastings Cutoff, which had originally, the idea had been to go through Weber Canyon north of Salt Lake. But because of some extenuating circumstances, they were directed by Hastings to not go that route, that it had been more difficult than Hastings thought it would be, and to therefore go a different route into the Great Salt Lake Valley and then across the Salt Flats that way. And the route that they took was what became Immigration Canyon. And the Saints, when they came the next year, they would have spent weeks doing exactly what the Donner Party spent weeks doing, and that was clearing a trail. And the Saints had very little that they had to clear. And in a way, you could say that God had kind of sent the Donner Party ahead to clear an easier path for the Saints. And that's where I kind of hesitated, because, you know, what happened to the Donner Party was a tragedy. And I don't want to downplay what happened to them or make it sound like God was purposely condemning them to what took place in the Sierra Nevada mountains. But it was indeed a great blessing for the Latter-day Saints when they came that next year, and they did not have to go through clear as much as they would have otherwise.
Well, I think you can read it theologically in another way that isn't maybe quite so objectionable, and that would simply be to say that God can get good even out of bad. In this case, the Donner Party story was a very bad one. It's tragic and so on, and yet it could be turned to good in some ways, and this was one of the ways perhaps in which it was. Well, we're actually running a little bit long on time. I know we've got some important things to say, you know, verses 7 and 8 of this chapter 45 strike me as important in sort of summing up one of the themes or sub-themes here. God sent me before you, Joseph says to his brothers, to preserve your posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now, it was not you that sent me hither, but God. Now, that's analogous to his giving credit to God for dream interpretations earlier on in speaking to the Pharaoh, that it's not because of my learning that I can do this. It's not my capacity. God has done it. God will give me the interpretation. In this case, you aren't the ones who did it. God did it. There's a real sense of the sovereignty of God in this story. That you know, in the dreams, God knows things in advance. He can tell you in advance. He's the sovereign of history. He knows what's going to happen. That's a really, really important point. I wanted to make one last comment myself about the reaction of Jacob. They come and tell him, and he's astonished. He says, it's enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. He finds it hard to believe, actually, according to verse 26 of chapter 45, that Joseph is still alive. This is one difference between the Quranic narrative and the biblical narrative, and it's a significant one. It says something about the nature of prophets. In the Quran, Jacob never believes them that Joseph is dead. He always knows that they're trying to fool him. There's something funny going on here. He doesn't know exactly what it is, but he knows that Joseph is still alive because it's part of Islamic traditional Islamic dogma that prophets really cannot be deceived. Prophets know. Prophets are inerrant. You can't fool them. But that isn't part of the mainstream biblical viewpoint or the Latter-day Saint viewpoint. We don't believe prophets are supermen. It's not in them. It's more like Joseph's comment here. It's not in me to lead the church. It's in the Spirit of God to lead the church. And so that, I think, is a theme here. God is sovereign. It's not the human capacity. And prophets, chosen though they are not superhuman in any way. Are there any other comments? I know that Jeff wanted to say something about the sequel. Is there anybody who wants to say something about chapter 45 before we move to that?
I actually think this is a good note to end on, so I think we ought to just wrap up with 45, which is where the lesson itself ends. So I think
okay.
That's good.
All right. Well, if no one else has anything to say, I'm willing to block it off there, end it there. I think you could tell from some of the coughing throughout this that several of us at least are recovering from encounters with germs or viruses.
Maybe with the east wind there.
That right, it might be the east wind, the Khamsin. And now this is perpetually enshrined on computer for people to watch and enjoy. So I'd like to thank Craig Foster, Martin Tanner, Jeff Bradshaw, and John Gee, Dan Peterson. So thank you to everybody on behalf of the Interpreter Foundation. We hope these are useful. We like to think that we're being of some help. We certainly enjoy talking about these great scriptural stories and passages. But thank you very much.